Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. Coming up, Marty Jo Link. Her soon-to-be-released memoir, Bootstrapper, is already attracting national attention. Poet and river guide Chris Dombrowski. He'll read from his new book, Earth Again. And we'll hear about summer workshops at Interlaken for adult writers. Sitting across the table is Marty Jo Link. Welcome, Marty.
Hi, Aaron.
Marty is a graduate of Michigan State University in journalism. She had a career as a police reporter, then took a bit of a sabbatical to have some children, and a few years ago started writing true crime.
I did, yes.
And had some great success with it. The two books are When Evil Came to Good Heart and Isidore's Secret.
Right.
And we were able to interview you on those books. And now a very different book. Bootstrapper, a memoir. It has a subtext to it, how you went from being a northern Michigan farmer to an extremely tough woman.
Pure stubbornness, I've heard.
Pure stubbornness. Before you started on this book, we were having a conversation and you had talked to your mother about it, and your mother said, "Now, Marty, whatever happened to you that was awful enough for you to be able to write a memoir?" And I just remember that so well, because memoirs often have sort of outrageous things that happen to the narrator.
Right, right. Actually, I called her from the parking lot of the Traverse City Library, and I had just gotten the book deal. And I told her I was going to be writing a memoir and that I was leaving the library with a stack of memoirs to read. And she said, "What have you done?" Almost like I was in trouble. And so I think there is that idea that you have to have climbed Everest or survived a disease or visited a remote part of the planet to have something worth writing about. I have probably a pretty ordinary story of struggle and parenthood and a mother's love for her kids. I had one pretty pivotal year, and this memoir is about that pivotal year.
And it really speaks to what happens to so many families, where we need to have two incomes to sort of survive. And you were ending a 20-year marriage and breaking apart a household, then facing some enormous parenting challenges and economic challenges.
Right. And I had this dream of raising my children in with a rural lifestyle. I had this idea that we would grow our own food, we would raise our own meat, my kids would spend a lot of time outside as opposed to in front of a television screen. And I was not willing to give that up. I didn't want my kids to be raised in, like, every, what I thought at the time, every other kid, that I didn't want them sitting. Mm-hmm. I wanted them active. And I wanted them to learn how to do things for themselves and be outside and appreciate the natural world. And I wasn't willing to give that up, even though we really couldn't afford to have that dream anymore. It's interesting how raising all of your own food has become expensive.
So when you got started with the memoir, it certainly has an arc to it. We have this huge series of problems that develop early on, most of which are connected to insufficient quantities of money.
Right. And my children were young, and they required a lot of time and energy, but also a lot of money. It's expensive to raise kids. And I was a terrible planner, Aaron. I was an awful planner. And so part of the reason that we were in those circumstances was because I had a very naive idea of what it took to keep a family going by myself.
Well, you relate in the book a point where you are talking to an official of the court who has software that determines how much money an ex-spouse should give to their former wife.
Right.
And you sort of reject the answer that the software is putting out.
Right, and I rejected the name. The name of that software was the Prognosticator. So I came to think of it as Oz behind that curtain. I guess I just rejected the idea that a computer could decide what was best for children and what was best for families.
So your challenges early on were, number one, keeping the farm.
Right. Right. And keep in mind, this was when Michigan was just starting to go into the downward spiral. Real estate values were starting to slip, and people were starting to lose their jobs, and prices were starting to rise. So the first thing was to keep the house and keep the property. I had a farmhouse with 6 acres. And number two was to feed us.
I was going to say, the next thing is, and you had 3 growing boys who were sort of eating constantly.
Right, yes.
But you were really resourceful. A big part of that is your garden.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm pretty good at raising vegetables, so I had a huge garden that was pretty successful. I know how to can. I know how to preserve things. But we also looked into how we were going to get protein. We weren't just going to be able to eat zucchinis forever.
And you had a cookbook. I think it was your grandmother's Betty Crocker cookbook that had Depression recipes.
Yes, and it was in that cloth-bound red binder. There's probably many people that have one of those still in their kitchen from their grandmother. And it had a whole section called meat stretchers in it. And it was a way to stretch your meat or to make up protein, stretch your grocery dollar.
Yeah. And there was a very special steak in that book.
Yes, there was something called emergency steak. And you would mix Wheaties, which I have to say, caveat, I never made this. But you would mix Wheaties with some kind of ground meat and form it into a patty in the shape of a T-bone steak. And then you would take a sliver of carrot and lay it across the patty to make it look like the bone. Now, I never made that, but it's starkly outlined in my mind as to what could have been ahead for me if I didn't come up with other ideas.
And then you had to clothe the 3 boys.
I did, right? Yeah, and keep our house warm.
Keep your house warm, which at one point was really desperate problem.
We had a difficult winter that winter. We had a lot of snow. It was pretty cold. And I had an ancient house with bad insulation.
Or no insulation.
Or no insulation, right. My house was built in 1900, and so not a lot of engineering marvel went into the original construction.
But you were tremendously resourceful. You were out hustling logs, driving around in your van and picking up branches and logs wherever you could find them.
We did, yep.
I mean, the boys are going to have a wonderful memory of this time.
You know what's interesting is I've given an early copy of the book to all 3 of the boys. Mm-hmm. And they've read it and they've said to me, you know, Mom, we remember all of those things. All those things happened. But we didn't know that you were afraid or desperate or worried or scared. We just thought it was fun. We just thought that's what people did. That's how, you know, that's how people were. Now, there were a few times that real life crept in. I tried to protect the kids. I didn't mm-hmm. want them to know how worried I was. I didn't want children to be forced to deal with adult worries.
Yes.
So if they don't remember those, I feel like I did my job mm-hmm. at the time. There were a few times when they were aware that things were happening, like when we raised the pig, and my middle son wasn't thrilled about telling his friends that that's where our pork chops came from. But for the most part, they were unaware.
Speaking of that pig, you had disasters that happened along the way. I should say here that I am talking to Marty Link, and we are talking about Bootstrapper, a memoir. So the pig and the disaster. You have this pig, you raise it, you are just so happy because you're going to have protein throughout the winter, and then you have a power failure.
Right. We had a power failure when we had a big snowstorm. And at the time, I was sick with the flu. And so I wasn't making a lot of meat because I just couldn't stomach cooking it. And so a few weeks went by and I didn't realize that we had had a power failure and our ancient freezer did not turn back on when the power came back on. Our power was only off for a couple hours. And the freezer was in the basement and it had everything that we had raised from the garden that wasn't canned, everything that was left from the pig was there, and it all spoiled. It was devastating to me. That was what was going to keep us fed until the spring, and it was all gone.
But that resourcefulness continues to come on throughout the rest of the book, mm-hmm. that each problem you readjust.
Right. Yeah. It was definitely a year of readjustment. And spring did come. You know, spring came. And I think there are also some wonderful funny moments in the memoir. It's not all desperation and worry and fear. There, you know, resourcefulness can be funny and striving can be funny. And all of those things can also be enjoyable, too. So there's quite a bit of that in the story as well.
Well, I think that's certainly a part of the richness of the book. The memoirs that your mother was referring to of people running up Everest are pretty distant from most of our lives.
Right.
But your book is something that most of us have experienced in one way or another. It's
right.
A very approachable kind of text and a very hopeful kind of story.
I hope so. I hope it is. I think that it feels to me almost like we lived on love for a year. Those boys would do anything I asked, and they're my heroes. They're really the heroes of the story. I'm certainly not. My other books are about people's bad judgment, and in a way, in this book,
and
I turned
my... And sometimes just bad people.
Right. In this book, I feel like I turned that reporter's eye on my own poor judgment, but the boys are the heroes.
There are a couple of male characters outside of your family that are still part of the story. For that year, an ex-husband lived across the road.
He did. Mm-hmm.
So he was still sort of part of your life.
Right. And he was very much part of the boys' lives.
And continued to be.
Yes.
And then there was another man who had been working on repairing your house or doing remodeling. And when your family fell apart financially, he sort of disappeared, but he was always sort of out there.
He was, and he disappeared because I couldn't pay him for the work anymore. but he would occasionally give me a call, or he would show up and anonymously plow our long snow-covered driveway.
Which was enormously helpful.
Very, very helpful. He would ask, what's going on with the remodel? Can you rehire me? But yeah, he stayed in the picture off and on.
And is there an ending to that?
There isn't. He appears in the epilogue. And
he appears in the epilogue, and it's the only epilogue that I've ever read that I witnessed.
I know. What did you think? Could you feel yourself?
I was right there again. It was just wonderful.
Yeah.
So the book goes full circle. I mean, it's a wonderful story, a rich read, and maybe we can get you to read from the book.
I would love to. So all you need to know for this reading is that Mrs. Donahue is a chicken that I named after my kindergarten teacher, that Larry is a clerk, very knowledgeable clerk at Tractor Supply, that the meats are the chickens we were raising for
meat,
and that Ben is my brother.
Ah. Oh, and that the meats are enormously nasty.
Very nasty. After a summer of doing nothing but eating and scratching and clucking and fertilizing, our hens are finally laying eggs. And Larry was right, too, because their eggshells are an amazing blue and green. The yolks, though, are bright orange, and for the next several days I feed the boys our own scrambled eggs for breakfast. They taste the way fresh grass smells and are better than any supermarket egg ever. With Mrs. Donahue gone, the rest of the hens stick close together, and though they wouldn't be laying eggs if they were overly stressed, I can still tell they would rather be inside the coop, at least at night. The meats aren't about to let that happen, An unsuspecting visitor would never mistake our farm for the Big Valley television show with them roaming free. No, they'd think they'd been dropped onto the set of a horror film, starring a cast of zombified birds. The meat seemed like a completely different species, bulked up to the size of steamer trunks, and bulging now as if unmentionables were hidden inside. They weigh as much as bowling balls, and their skinny legs wobble under the strain. Not only that, but there are piles of chicken crap everywhere you step. So much for containing this byproduct to use as fertilizer. And if you bend over to wipe off your shoe, expect an attack from the rear. These, I am convinced, are the foul descendants of the rooster whose crowing in triplicate signaled Jesus's impending betrayal. I make a farmer's decision. It's time for them to die. I cut recipes for chicken pot pie out of the newspaper and plan on a stuffed chicken instead of a turkey for Thanksgiving this year. I know exactly which chicken I want to invite to our table for the holiday. The one with a thing for ankles. I'll fix your little red wagon, pal, I promise. My brother gave us his freezer, and I have big plans to pack it full of legs, thighs, breasts, and roasters. I consider calling Pete to do the deed. Decide we are not yet to this place in our new relationship, and sit down with the Yellow Pages instead, and look up butchers. It takes a few phone calls, but someone finally explains that I'm not going to be able to find a commercial butcher to come to my farm and slaughter my chickens. Michigan's legislature has outlawed farm calls, which means meat retailers are no longer allowed to come to your farm and kill stuff. Now you either have to kill your livestock yourself or take it to a USDA-inspected meat processing plant. The closest one to me is past Grand Rapids, 160 miles to the south. The prospect of 3 hours of highway driving accompanied by 15 angry bowling balls with feathers, beaks, and leg spurs is not a trip I relish or even contemplate. I've got to talk to Larry. Land sakes, girl, he bellows from the help desk, tiring, I'm sure, by now of my relentless questions. You can kill a chicken. Get a funnel, stick the heads in, chop them off, let them drain, parboil the feathers off, gut them, bag them, and toss them in the freezer for the winter. I couldn't kill a hog last fall, and I don't think I can unleash the big ass on a chicken today, either. Maybe I would be able to kill one if it had on a black balaclava and was coming at me in my bedroom in the dark with a knife. But I know myself, and I know I cannot kill 15 chickens. Not without years of therapy, anyway, and I don't have that kind of time. As brutal as my foul charges have turned out to be, I still raise the meats from tiny babies. I can eat them, but I can't murder them, hypocritical as that may be. Instead, I stop at the cashier on the way out of Tractor Supply and pay for another 40-pound bag of chicken feed. The meat portion of our chicken raisin experiment has obviously gone off the rails. Just when they were beginning to relax with Pecker gone, my sons are being attacked in their own yard again, our entire wardrobe of footwear is ruined, and at $11 a bag for feed, the costs are mounting. Maybe, I think, there are some non-commercial rural types who would consider doing the deed. I call the 4-H, the local food co-op, an organic rabbit farm, a commune in the next county. Will anyone butcher my chickens? Too late, don't do it, too messy, and dude, we're vegans, are my answers. I let the meats roam during the day, and they stray to a distant neighbor's yard and scratch up her landscape mulch. She no longer waves when she sees me at my mailbox. Their drumsticks, I am convinced, are getting tougher by the day, and they have pecked all the grapes off my grapevine. They drink the water out of my landscape pond and terrify the koi. Even the cats fear them. On a day I shoo the meats out of the road where they have stopped traffic, my brother has apparently gotten his driver's license back because he arrives for an impromptu visit. "Those are pit bull chickens," he says, hurrying into my house and slamming the door. I hug him. Please kill them, I say, thinking of his gun collection.
Okay, Marty Link reading from Bootstrapper, a memoir. It's typical of the rest of the book. It really moves along as a text. Now let's talk about your career.
My career?
Yes. When I met you, you had been writing for 20 years. You had certainly written and published a lot of articles, but you hadn't done any books. Then you did two books in a row with University of Michigan Press, and they were well-received, well-reviewed, have attracted a readership, but sort of limited in terms of distribution.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, they had more of a geographical interest, I think.
Yes. So now you have stayed with this, and you are a very hard worker, and you are skilled at promotion. And the first print run on this book from Knopf is 50,000 copies.
I know, that's weighing.
I mean, isn't that exciting?
It's very exciting.
And the reason I'm talking about this is for all the writers out there, it just shows you what dedication to craft and hard work can do. But it certainly is hard work, and you've done that work.
It's hard work, but it's the best work there is, Aaron. It's the best work. There is nothing in the world like telling stories. There isn't true stories in mm-hmm. my case. There's no feeling like that, knowing that you are writing things that hopefully make other people feel the way that writers have made me feel. The best writers, when I read books, I'm just so transported. And if I can do that for readers, there is no feeling like that.
Where can listeners find more information about you?
They can go to my website, which is martijolink.com. And I also have a YouTube channel. I have some videos on YouTube. I've been experimenting with the video camera. I think in my next life, I would love to be a filmmaker because I'm just having so much fun with that. So they can check those out too.
Okay. And your calendar is on that website, and you have already appearances throughout the Midwest, all
right.
Spring, summer, and fall.
Right.
So coming to a bookstore or library near you, Marty Link. And what's next? I know that there's another book out there.
I have the third true crime book that I've been working on for about 6 years
mm-hmm.
that will be published sometime in 2013. I'm not sure when yet because I haven't finished it, but it's at the tail end of being done. And soon I'll have that story out. The title is Wicked Takes the Witness Stand, but I don't have a pub date for that. And in my spare time, I've been getting my master's in creative writing. So I'm writing quite a few essays. None of them have been published yet, but hopefully at some point, an essay collection.
Which is so interesting because you've already achieved the kind of success that most people who start that program hope to achieve.
I did it a little backwards.
Okay, Marty Jo Link, thank you for being here. The book again is?
Bootstrapper. Thanks, Aaron.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'm sitting with Chris Dombrowski. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Aaron.
Chris is the newest member of the creative writing faculty at the Interlochen Arts Academy. Before that, Chris, you're from the Lansing area?
Yeah, I grew up in Lansing.
And you went then to Hope College?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I went to Hope College in 1994 and studied with Jack Riddle there.
Very well-known poet and writer in this region. And then your life takes some interesting journeys. You head towards
Montana. Yeah. In 95, the winter of 95 or even the winter of 94, I had a friend who was traveling out there. I played on the soccer team at Hope College, and he said, I'm going out to snowboard. I need somebody to drive with me. And so I drove out there with him in the winter, and while we were there, we procured jobs for the summer, and went back to Hope and packed our boxes and got ready to leave in May. And so
the rest is history.
Mm-hmm.
And the job you had that summer?
That summer I was coaching soccer. I coached soccer for 2 years. I had this fantastic boss who was as crazy about fly fishing as I was. And we would coach soccer during the day, camps, mm-hmm. week-long camps at the university there in Bozeman. And after coaching, we would immediately go and grab a bite to eat and then fish until dark. And one stretch that summer, I fished for 52 days straight with this guy, Rich Brouse. He was my boss, and he let us crash in his basement, and that was it.
So that then began a second career, though.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Or a first career.
Sure.
I don't know where you are in careers.
Well, I'm retired, actually. I'd grown up in Michigan, and I'd spent a lot of time fishing the Au Sable up near Grayling.
Yep, the Holy Waters.
The Holy Waters, sure. And I worked at Gates Au Sable Lodge there as basically a gopher. For years, I tied flies, I painted cabins, I cleaned the bathrooms, I spotted cars, I did whatever my boss, Rusty Gates, told me to do. And somewhere in that span of time, I got the wild hair that it'd be a pretty good life to be a fishing guide, you know. The folks I looked up to there were the old... the old sage guides there, Charlie Weaver and Jimmy Calvin and George Alexander, these men who had spent 30 years on the river. And I thought, well, you know, there's not a cooler job in the world. So when I migrated west, I found a niche as a fishing guide a few years after I arrived there. Maybe in 98, I think I started guiding, or 97. I'd have to go back and look at my tag there, but this will be my 17th summer taking people fishing on the rivers of western Montana.
So you studied with Jack Riddle, you were interested in poetry, and then we got into this fishing career.
Yeah.
Did you go back to graduate school immediately, or did
I went back to graduate school in 1999, and... So soon after, but not immediately, I had a couple years off. I even had a winter where I taught in inner city Chicago, taught high school down in Hyde Park. And, you know, it was the writer Norman McLean said that for him, going back and forth between University of Chicago, where he taught, and Seeley Lake, Montana, where he lived in the summers, he said it was a recipe for schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while there, that was my feeling as well, going back and forth between teaching in the school years or some literary pursuits,
yes,
and fishing, guiding in the summers. It was a little bit of a recipe for schizophrenia, but over the years, it became just kind of part and parcel, if you will. It became... the way the seasons unfolded, you know, in the summer and the spring, I'd get on the river, and in the fall, I'd be done and back to the books, and so on. So it's really just become a way of life for me now after all these years.
So today we're going to be talking about your newest volume of poetry, Earth Again, from Wayne State University Press, 2012?
13, actually.
2013.
Yeah.
Just out?
Just out.
And what's the theme of this book?
You know, it's funny you should ask that. I've been thinking about the theme. There's certainly the theme of memory throughout the book. There's a theme of desire. I think there's a lot of eros in the book. There was an old kind of cult fly fishing book published about 15 years ago by a man named John Gearock called Sex, Death, and Fly Fishing.
Mm-hmm.
With a title
like that, you can't lose.
Yeah, you can't lose. So I thought the other day, if I had to retitle this book, would it be Sex, Death, and Something, but I couldn't quite think of the third, you know, the third tier of the title there. But I would say, you know, if there's a theme of this book, it is desire and death and regeneration.
And your children sort of play a part in the book. You have three young children who, that's sort of a third career.
Yeah, or it's the number one career, certainly, yeah.
In terms of time, it's number one.
It is, and the most rewarding too, you know. My first book was a lot also published by Wayne State, was a lot more isolated and hermetic, if you will. Mm-hmm. This one, I hope at least, is more engaged with the world. Both technically, there are a lot more interruptions in the work, line by line. There, poem by poem, there's less of a straightforward, unerring narrative, more of a kind of interrupted, lyrical way of looking at the world, if you will. There are lots of moments where a poem will have a line of dialogue from a child or something like that. And so, yeah, I do find that the children really feed the work with a spirit of adventure and discovery and purity, I hope. Anyway, and so I try to rob as much of that as I can, you know.
Well, it certainly comes out in these poems. Could we look at these poems? Have you read some?
Sure, absolutely. Well, Aaron, this is a poem, a prose poem called Tarnation, and it was born out of a story that my niece and nephew told me. They live in a Chicago suburb north of the city, and not far from a wildlife preserve, a wetland where waterfowl hunting takes place. And they were sitting at the bus stop one morning waiting for the bus and, you know, hearing, as they often did, shotgun reports from over the hill. And out of nowhere or out of the sky, a goose came. It had been winged, and it was not going to make it very far and ended up landing at the bus stop. So
that's a wonderful story.
So this is a poem that does its best, anyway, to evoke that experience. And there are a couple of parentheticals in here, and that's when I was talking about interruption, I guess that's what I meant. Tarnation. When the goose fell dead at the bus stop, it was not quite dead. The hunter, having taken a high shot because the goose would not decoy, the spreading wad of bismuth pellets shattering only the left phalange, barely piercing the breast. So when a plucky girl broke the semicircle of wavering boys, reached to hoist the bird in her arms, its black head shot out hissing, its good wing flailed Icarus-like, though the children knew nothing of him yet, fanning gutter trash until the chocolate lab arrived, stretching with each purposed stride the neoprene camo vest, scrotum bouncing, toenails clicking ridiculously on the cul-de-sac sidewalk, to clamp his jaws after a brief scurry, stutter flight, around the pillowed shoulders of the goose that was still not quite dead. Shotgun-shouldered, afraid so, the hunter soon appeared, a tad portly, knelt and pried bird from beast's mouth, stroked the tooth-torn plumage, scratched his good boy behind the ear, then twisted the bird's esophagus shut, stepping back from the throes as the bus, yellow, lethargic as a swath of mill-tinged dawn, climbed, crested the hill, and coasted to a curbside stop, its driver surveying the scene, tarnation, releasing the brakes, filling the poised air with a collective gasp.
Well, you really paint a convincing story there, don't you?
Well, I remember listening to my niece and nephew tell this story and how traumatized they'd been by it. And to me, it seemed a real kind of emblem, if you will, for where we are as a society, and that is, you know, we're at a place where our ecotones kind of overlap. The wetlands that had been,
yes,
you know, a hunting ground for years, and even before that, you know, for the first people, are now suburbs, and mm-hmm. The kids wait for the bus there. So I hope the poem doesn't cast judgment on anyone, but just says, here we are, and this is the situation.
So that is perhaps a nice segue into the weekly apocalypse.
Sure, yeah, weekly apocalyptic. This is a poem that, if I had to say, well, it actually follows directly that Tarnation poem right in the book. And, you know, you read the news, and there seems to be something every week or every day that makes you feel like, oh, man, we're this is the big one, right?
This is the big one.
So I tried to, in this poem, both poke fun at that notion but also engage with it as well. So the title is Weekly Apocalyptic, or Poem Written on the Wall in an Ascending Space Capsule. We had to stop what we were doing to see what we had done. Thing was, we wouldn't. How devoted we were to despising one another, to erecting our own private islands made of water bottles and various other plastic disposables. "Will you forgive me?" was a phrase stricken from our language. Theirs, too. They ballooning to include nearly everyone but that arcane term, us. Upon discovering that gulls feasting on our dead but unearthed bodies died of our toxicity, we sobered up, but couldn't stand to look at ourselves in what was left of the light. Despite what so many movies had taught us, just in time was a tick too late. There was this bird we used to call a whippoorwill.
That's Chris Dombrowski reading from Earth Again from Wayne State University Press, and you're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. Chris, where are we going now?
I'll read this prose poem, May. It's about an encounter I had on the river years ago. I would say a dozen, maybe, Mays ago on the Clark Fork River in western Montana. It had been a rainy spring. And one day I was out on the river and saw a bird doing some weird flight in a tree. And I thought, well, that's weird. You know, is that a mating flight or what? And then I got closer to it, and I could see that the bird had attempted to eat a fly, a trout fly, that had been snagged with some tippet onto a pine bough. And so this is the poem that came out of that occasion. And the first line of the poem comes from a Montana poet named Richard Hugo. May. Birds here should have names so hard to say you name them over. Someone dead wrote that. But yesterday, watching the struggling flycatcher, Hammond's, dusky, willow, I'm not sure. I thought it. Beak pierced by some errant angler's snagged gray wolf, the bird flailed circles around a branch, the monofilament line coiling tighter with each brief orbit. All this while you were teaching. Snow in the first week of May, then sunshine, then midges, then mayflies, then stones. The bug's wrinkled wings like sheets a body has risen from, late for whatever it had to do. Mary, the warblers, tree swallows, the phoebes feasted on the numb bugs, dashing down on the river, veering, their bellies like white shirts beneath unbuttoned coats. Then snow again, and the birds buttoned up, raced for the branches. Your students, faces flushed, lined up after recess. All except Shannon, last again, out there playing tetherball alone. It's May, sweetie. It's time for class. This morning, studying the field guide, I can't tell a yellow-bellied from a least, a peewee from an olive-sided. Pip, pip, I say there, sings one of them. Pill, pill, sings another. Ho, say, Maria. The bird that sang like it had swallowed too much water hung in the man-made gallows, and with the bow rope I broke the branch, with forceps pried the steel from its beak. It lit in a dogwood, bent-necked. The watery sound of the nothing it sang, friable thing gone from my palm. May, how a student slurring her words might say your name.
Interesting mixture of your two professional lives.
Yeah, yeah. This next poem has a teacherly figure in it, if you will. And it's called Small Fire in Snow. It's an Ars Poetica, if you will. It's a short poem, just 11 lines long. Small Fire in Snow. However arrogant I had to be, to say something like, it's what a poem is, I was. While you honed a beech branch end, and with it clinically stabbed four hot dogs, asking, did I remember the ketchup? You didn't trust me? No. Certainly not enough to let me cook the Franks, wrapped now in bluish flames, skins splitting open, charring, for fear I might turn the meal, you said, taking the first juice-spitting bite, into a metaphor, and you were hungry.
It's not easy living with a poet.
No, it's not. That's an old, saying. Charles Simic, former poet laureate of the United States, poet, wonderful poet and teacher, he says there's an old saying in his country that when the poet announces his occupation, the family runs.
Ah. So among the themes in the book, and we're talking about Earth again, is grief and loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this poem here, Partial Eclipse, deals with those themes. The subtitle of the poem is the longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates to a peak called Lolo Peak in the Bitterroot Range, not far from our house in Missoula, Montana. We were talking this morning, you and I, about adventurers, recreational or otherwise, mm-hmm. and this friend of ours, Chris Spurgeon, was a dynamo of a man, insatiable and just a physically amazing. He would wake up in the morning and just say, I think I'll run 40 miles today. You know, can you come and pick me up in Stevensville? And someone would be there to pick him up several hours later after he'd put 38 or 40 miles on his treads. So he passed away in an avalanche while he was backcountry skiing there. This will be the third anniversary coming up. Partial Eclipse. A friend's early death had me thinking about death, as did the plastic toy stegosaur I ran over with the mower, when the sputtering engine and day's umber finality had me thinking along similar lines. This is the way it goes with death, I heard me telling myself in a voice I have developed over the years to cope with such situations, though I don't trust so much as resigned to it. C was crushed while skiing the backcountry when a mid-June avalanche unseated the peak he'd stared at from his kitchen window several hours earlier while fixing a breakfast of toast and venison, as the room filled with dawn's initial hue and the slight hiss of butter losing its shape in the skillet. What one does so early in the day is one's own business. I delivered newspapers as a boy and prefer to let a decent hour arrive before waking. Today, though, Molly startled me at 4:37, screaming, I want you, Daddy. And as I held her until the offending dream gave way to some less threatening vision, the eclipsing moon I declined to set an alarm for appeared between the curtains, as much moon as I have in my thumbnail. silver handle by which some god held a pail filled with water drawn from the cosmos' deepest well. I stepped outside in time to see the vast mouth swallow all but the last slice of pear. Blood rush of the creek, the robin's somnolent calls, a deafening surround to these thoughts, which a sizable portion of me would have preferred to sleep through. All but the top of my head, the urnful I will be, buried warmly under the quilts. Momentarily, the snowy peak on which he left his body arrived in daylight, or daylight arrived on the peak. They met, made a horizon line, and said nothing of how at dusk in June up there one might see a nighthawk drop from its invisible precipice, the edges of its wings audibly sawing the ozone, slitting a seam in the void into which he slipped.
Wow.
Really powerful poem. Chris, we have time for about one more poem, and it will be?
My recently implanted government eco guilt chip.
Ah, everyone should have one.
Everyone will have one, I think.
Okay.
I had this strange premonition a few years ago. I thought, you know, it's clear we all know, we've heard the signs that we're not doing our job to take care of this earth. And yet, here I am drinking out of a plastic water bottle again. Or here I am driving, you know, 150 miles to see a concert or something like that. So
none of us are clean.
Right. The blood is on everyone's hands, right?
Absolutely.
So what will we do to fix things? And one kind of sci-fi premonition that I had is that each one of us will be implanted with a little microchip at the top of our spine.
To measure our carbon footprint?
Well, not just to measure our carbon footprint, but to make us feel guilty for the things we do. So anyway, I couldn't quite entertain that hypothetical poetically, so I engaged with it as if it were an actuality.
Okay.
My recently implanted government eco-guilt chip is zapping me from a millimeter beneath the skin at the top of my spine to inform me that my morning movement, the paper with which I wiped, and the flush that sent it all sewerward has cost the planet 6 gallons of fresh aquifer water and 2 sturdy limbs from a Virginia oak forest where formerly rough grouse thrived when acorns abounded. This information was relayed to me via text message, along with a prescription for a single pill of unknown pharmaceutical composition, which I must, by law, ingest before lunch to ensure my brain chemistry is properly altered and sufficient feelings of remorse ensue. Since I work at noon, I will have to drive, not bike, to the pharmacy, thus activating the chip again and triggering a more potent prescription. It is all enough to make one cry, and being one, I do, shedding ample tears and reaching momentarily for a Kleenex before drying my eyes on my sleeve.
Oh my, lots of guilt there. Okay, the school year is ending. You will be back in the river before long.
I can't wait.
Chris Dombrowski, where can listeners find your books in Northern Michigan?
Horizon Books and Brilliant Books in Traverse City carry my books.
Okay, and they can go to Wayne State University Press website and find information there. Do you have a website?
I don't have a personal website, no.
But if you Google your name, you get a lot of hits with information about you. Did you know that?
I've heard that. People tell me that.
I just checked it out this morning. Yeah. So we wish you well this summer, and thank you for being on Michigan Writers.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's been a delight.
Matthew Williford is here. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks, Aaron.
Matthew is the director of the Interlochen College of Creative Arts, which means what?
Well, the College of Creative Arts is our adult education component here at Interlochen, and it's an opportunity for adults to engage in their creative interests so that they can have the expressive life that they're seeking. We offer a lot of opportunities for study in music, of course, and visual arts.
But today you're here to talk about
creative writing.
Creative writing. So what's on the schedule for this summer?
For writing?
Yes.
Well, for writing programs for adults this summer, we have our initial flagship program, which is our Writer's Retreat, which is held in mid-June. And then we also have a mystery writing workshop. And we also have, or I should say, we also have a crime writing workshop. And then we also, in August, offer a program called Making Meaning of Our Memories, which is a standalone memoir writing workshop.
So could you connect some names to these programs and talk about what happens in them?
Sure. Well, the Writer's Retreat, we have four faculty members and an artistic director. And the artistic director for the Writer's Retreat is Katie Schultz. A dynamic personality, a very talented up-and-coming writer who's actually in the process of releasing her first book.
Her book will be out in June, I believe.
Yeah, yes. It's called Flashes of War. Don't miss it. And then we have four genres that are available for study within the Writer's Retreat. Our fiction genre is led this year by Patty McNair, who's the author of The Temple of Air.
That book got tremendous number of awards in the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I often joke with her that she's stealing all of the awards from other struggling writers. but as a matter of fact, her genre is already full for the Writer's Retreat this year. And then we have Anne-Marie Oman, who's leading our memoir genre and well-known in this region. She bases a lot of her work on growing up in a rural farm environment. So she uses a lot of descriptive language in that process with
her. She has perhaps two of the best contemporary memoirs out there.
Yeah, fantastic. Then we have a poetry genre, and this year our poetry faculty member is James Arthur. Oh. And James is another emerging poet. Comes to us from the New York metropolitan area. Currently, he is a Hodder Fellow at the Lewis Center for the Arts in Princeton, New Jersey. So we're really looking forward to having James with us this summer. And then the fourth genre, and it's new this year to us, is writing for children and young adults. And that's led by Louise Hawes from North Carolina. And she's fascinating in that that's really been her primary genre that she's worked in. But she's written both fiction works, biography, authored picture books, and graphic novels. So it's interesting to see this very grandmotherly looking writer who has authored essentially comic book graphic novels.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're doing one more thing, and I think it's only a day workshop. You're going to have Philip Hartigan do a workshop on blogging.
Yes. That is also new this year, and we've scheduled it to be the Friday following the close of the Writer's Retreat. So if anyone is planning to attend the Writer's Retreat, this makes a very natural add-on if anyone's interested in blogging as a writer or an artist, or it can be a standalone experience. Philip Hartigan is a visual artist from Chicago. He's actually the partner of Patty McNair, our fiction faculty member. And he started his own blog for his own promotion and reflection of his visual artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And as an outshoot of that, he was actually then contacted by Hyperallergic, which is an art blog based in New York City, and also he writes for Time Out Chicago. So he has experience in expanding from both personal blogging, which then mm-hmm. became contracted blogging. So he will be here as a one-day workshop to help interested parties develop that for their own behalf and promotion.
So how much experience does a prospective participant need?
They have to have a true desire to learn the craft of writing. It's not about having a body of work to look back upon. It really, truly does not require a background in writing per se.
So if you just have desire, you can show up and begin
Absolutely.
Working on your writing.
Right, because you have to start somewhere, right?
Exactly.
You know this as a writer. I mean, it comes with the first word.
Because I know many people are sort of intimidated about this whole thing.
True.
And yet I've been in a number of these workshops. There are experienced writers, but there are lots of people who just thought about writing are interested in it, and it is their first experience sometimes.
Probably the most rewarding part is that for those folks that are hesitant about engaging in that first step in becoming a writer or committing to the art of writing is just the community dynamic from all of the collective participants that come to this retreat or any of our other workshops. And it's truly an encouraging thing because even though you might be a beginner, even the folks that are accomplished or veteran writers have been in those shoes before. So they're very much encouraging. It's not a judgmental process. And there's not a lot of critique for the sake of being a critic, mm-hmm. but for helping people develop and understand the craft. And it is a craft.
Well, it's a beautiful facility to work in. It's a wonderful setup that you create and wonderful atmosphere. And if listeners want to get more information, what's the process?
Well, they can visit our website, college.interlochen.org, or they can call our phone number, area code 231-276-7387.
So, Matthew Williford, thank you for being here, and we are looking forward to another summer of writing at the Interlochen College of Creative Arts.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Marty Jo Link, Chris Dombrowski, and Matthew Williford for their time. Also, kudos to Brock Mormon, Brad Aspey, and Peter Payette, all of whom bring great knowledge and skill to the engineering and production of this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen again next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.